And we're talking about the Zodiac Killer. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with our guests, but I will open up a special hotline for anyone out there who might be the Zodiac Killer, if that person is still alive. And please leave that line open only for that person. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Michael Butterfield, Tom Voigt, and Ed Neal. Michael, let me ask you first. A lot of people have been suspected of being the Zodiac through the years, but one, Arthur Leigh Allen, who is dead now, was seriously investigated. Tell us about him.
Well, Arthur Leigh Allen was a convicted child molester who was first turned into police in 1971, as far as we know, by an estranged friend who came forward to police and said that Allen had purportedly confessed to these crimes before they occurred, said that he was going to commit crimes similar to the Zodiac murders and use the name Zodiac in taunting letters to the police. The police investigated Allen for approximately a year, and at the end of that year, they really didn't come up with anything better than the story from that friend, and using the information they had, they were able to get a search warrant for a trailer Allen used in Santa Rosa, California. And they were unable to find any evidence, and essentially they dropped the investigation after that. And although he was the subject of interest in the years after that, it wasn't until December of 1990, after a best-selling book had come out and used him as a suspect under a pseudonym, that another person from Allen's past came forward, a member of an organized crime family in Vallejo, who was in trouble with the law. Facing many years in prison for armed robbery, he said that he would be willing to name Allen as the Zodiac if he was given his freedom. And they didn't give him a deal, but Allen was reinvestigated, and it was under that scrutiny that Allen died in 1992. There's a lot of suspicions surrounding Allen, but you know, for the most part, I think even Tom and many of the other people who have done a lot of other work on Allen themselves would agree that while there is some evidence to suggest that Allen should be considered a good suspect in some ways, most of the things you hear about Arthur Leigh Allen are, in fact, not true.
Tom, does he fit the description of that fellow who was in the cab?
No. The witnesses really didn't describe a bald Pillsbury doughboy, so he didn't fit at all. I'd like to say that, you know, the fact is that Allen was forensically, his fingerprints didn't match the Zodiac's suspected fingerprints, and his palm prints didn't match the Zodiac's palm prints. His handwriting didn't match the Zodiac's handwriting, and his DNA didn't match the Zodiac. So, George, really, you're as good a suspect as Allen, because none of that matches you either. So, you know, if we're going to start
saying,
well, we haven't checked that yet.
Yeah, not yet. We will. But you know, if
willingly submit it to you all.
Okay, thank you. But I mean, there has to be some criteria. I mean, there has to be some. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I do watch Law and Order, and I know Jack McCoy would probably laugh if some cop wanted to, you know, have him indict Arthur Leigh Allen when none of the big stuff, matches. I mean, just because he was a weirdo, and just because he had some very strange sex toys, and just because he made some incriminating statements or like people to think he was the Zodiac, doesn't mean he was the Zodiac. And, you know, there's a movie out that basically says he was the Zodiac. And I don't care either way, because he either was or he wasn't. The fact is that if he was the Zodiac, then the person that turned him in 1969 is the one who should get credit for catching him, and nobody
sure.
else. Really.
But, George, you know, the interesting point of what Thomas is saying is that, you know, no one would indict Allen with this evidence. And that's something that you hear quite often, is that I think it's even mentioned at the end of the film that they were going to press charges against Allen, then he died, and, you know, he escaped justice by dying. Simple fact is that the evidence that exists, the evidence that existed then and exists today is certainly nowhere near even, it's not even what a police officer would want to bring to a prosecutor.
What about this Mr. X, Ed Neal? Who might that have been?
We're going to need a couple extra hours for that.
Who's giggling back there?
Yeah, well, I'll try and, you know, keep it short. But Mr. X was actually a suspect that I discovered with another investigator from out east by the name of Mike Rodelli. And he asked me, to have a look for letters to the editor wondering if maybe Zodiac had written to one of the newspapers here in the Bay Area using his own name. So using the search criteria that he had outlined, I'm not going to go into that because it'll be really super easy to find his real name.
Right.
I found a single letter that was very odd. He spoke about young, you know, children, teenagers, whatever, lying dead in the street. And he even referenced an editorial from a month earlier that mentioned Hitler. And I thought, gee, this is bizarre. And the name, it looked made up to me. So I made a copy of it, and I told Mike about it. And he, like, I know that guy. And it's like, you're kidding me. And we started looking into him. And there was a lot of really strange things. I mean, a lot of this information is already out there already, so I guess I'm pretty safe in saying it. But he lived not too far from where Paul Stein was shot by the Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
There's pictures
in the general direction of where the Zodiac was laying.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Not too far from his house. There's pictures out there that we found, and of course everyone has a different opinion of them, but there's one that I swear he looks like a dead ringer for the composite.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Now, that doesn't necessarily prove anything, because a lot of people look like that composite.
Yeah, and Tom and I have both spoken with that gentleman as well.
Yeah.
And did you pick up anything that would cause you to think that he possibly could be a suspect?
The way Zodiac's voice was described, confusing Mr. X with Zodiac based on his voice would be like confusing Regis Philbin for Chuck Liddell. I mean, it just doesn't fit.
But he was also a very friendly person who was very forthcoming, and there's no history of violence, no reason to suspect him of murder.
So you are ruling out Mr. X?
I would.
Absolutely. There's a lot of interesting things about this particular suspect, but they're all circumstantial, just like there is against every other suspect, and there's no smoking gun. That's the problem.
And Ed, that's the point, too. You know, after you have 45, 50, 60 people who come up with suspects that all have convincing circumstantial evidence, you realize the value of circumstantial evidence isn't that great.
Exactly.
Would you call Mr. X just weird?
No, I don't think he's weird at all. I think he's just one of those guys that, you know, just came under the crosshairs of someone looking for a suspect.
Yeah, no, he's got a lot of weird things about him, but I wouldn't call him weird himself.
I'm a lot weirder.
Is he still alive?
Oh yes.
He is.
Okay.
He was very friendly when I spoke with him just recently, and he actually sent me a copy of his autobiography. He sent one to Mike Rodelli as well.
He's that prominent?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Very. That's why we didn't name him.
And yeah, where does he live?
He lives in San Francisco.
He lives everywhere?
He's in San Francisco. He could afford to live everywhere.
He is a person of some wealth and notoriety in the Bay Area area and other places.
I mean, would I know his name?
Yeah, you might. It's possible. He's the kind of person that he's not a celebrity, but I think in his circles he's well known. And, you know, we're all doing him a tremendous service by not using his name here tonight, because there's absolutely no reason for him to really be a suspect. And he was very cooperative back in 2002 when ABC did a television special and asked for his DNA. And his DNA, you know, he didn't, you know, I would think the Zodiac would hesitate a little bit, but he turned it right over and it didn't match.
That is interesting. Okay,
that makes him as good a suspect as Arthur Lee Allen.
well, is this individual? Does he get offended when people even broach the subject to him?
He can. It all depends on how you broach it to him.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think if anything, he's probably more tired of hearing it than anything else, rather than being offended by it.
Yeah, I agree.
Tom and I and Ed, some of us have all spoken with some of the suspects over the years, and you know, you can often mistake someone's unwillingness to talk as being suspicious, when really it's that, you know, for their daily lives, this is just a nuisance.
All right, let me ask you again, outside of his uncanny resemblance to the composite, why would he even be considered a suspect?
Well, it's because of that letter and because of the proximity of the crime scene, but Ed's the person that should answer that.
Yeah, there are those, but then there was a few other interesting things. There's been an English connection that was suggested for the Zodiac, and it turns out that Mr. X has a connection to England. And then there was the sleigh letter, as it's called, from February 1974 that I don't believe has actually been authenticated. in which the author said that, you know, dear editor, did you know that Slay, S-L-A, for the Symbionese Liberation Army, spelled Slay, mm-hmm. which is an Old Norse word meaning kill, and it was just signed a friend. It's like, well, Norse, well, guess what? Mr. X has got a connection there. So there's just little things like that that have popped up that made, actually, Mike Rodelli more so than me suspicious. But it wasn't until I actually got a copy of his signature, it's like, this is nothing like the Zodiac's writing, and I was pretty much done with him at that point. All we're looking at is just a bunch of interesting coincidences that we see with, seriously, just about every other suspect out there.
All three of you believe the Zodiac could still be alive. Have any of you gotten a weird letter or phone call from someone purporting to be the Zodiac killer?
Well, Tom gets them all.
Yeah, I haven't got any.
But, Tom, with everything you get, is there anything there that has even raised your ire a little bit for you to say, well, this is possible?
No, not really. I don't think the Zodiac would. I think he's. I really believe, honestly, if he's still alive, you know, he'd have better things to do than call me at 3 o'clock in the morning or something. But I'm open to the possibility. I did get some hoax. I got some letters from Singapore and Atlanta from the same person who was claiming to be the Zodiac and sent me his fingerprints and DNA samples and so forth. And I turned that over to, I had a criminology professor at Sonoma State University, Mike Kelleher, who wrote a really excellent book about the case called This is the Zodiac Speaking. And I had him review all of the materials. And then I had them sent to the California Department of Justice for any type of DNA or forensic examination. And I haven't heard, I know it was done, and I'm assuming that it was just, you know, nothing came back. And I think since then we've identified who the individual was, and it was just a kook. But, you know, I get lots of email from people claiming to be the Zodiac, but you know, it's always from some 15-year-old kid that, you know, or, you know, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Kid, because you know, the email address is like pimpster69 at hotmail.com. And mm-hmm. I think if Zodiac had an email account, it wouldn't be pimpster.
Well, but that's also just another example of the strange phenomenon. You know, what would possess somebody to want to pretend to be a serial killer and write a forged letter or call up somebody and pretend, you know?
Well, look at the guy who claims that he did, that he killed JonBenet Ramsey.
Exactly.
Jean-Marc Carr, yeah.
Why would you want to inject yourself into something like that,
yeah.
You know, and create that kind of fear and terror for people all over again?
And, George, I'm glad you brought that up because there was a document examiner, a very famous question document examiner, who actually, like, is trained and he makes a living at this stuff. And he actually stated that he had examined Carr's handwriting and that Carr was the one who wrote the JonBenet Ramsey ransom note.
Yeah.
And so that just goes to show that, you know, these people that specialize in these inexact sciences.
Experts for hire.
Yeah, you have to take everything they say with a grain of salt, and you have to realize that they're not, you know, these polygraphers and handwriting experts and so
mm-hmm.
forth. These are things that were used to rule out suspects in the Zodiac case.
They're only as good as the people using them.
Yes, and it's you know, who knows? I think perhaps Zodiac, his handwriting was examined. The real Zodiac's handwriting was examined by a documents examiner, and they said, oh, no, this isn't the Zodiac's handwriting.
None of the letters typed, all handwritten?
There's only one typed letter that's attributed to the Zodiac, and that's from the still unsolved murder of Cherry Joe Bates in Riverside, California from 1966. It was a so-called confession letter in which he described how he murdered this young woman and warned us all that he was going to do it again.
Any information to show that he stalked the victims days or weeks before he killed them?
No, there's no credible evidence to suggest that the Zodiac knew any of the victims. There's a lot of theories that the Zodiac knew Darlene Farron, one of the victims shot at Blue Rock Springs on July 4th.
22-year-old lady.
Yeah, there's because she had a lot of male admirers and a lot of friends and surrounded by people who like to tell some tall tales in the years after her murder failed to be solved, just like any unsolved case, a lot of theories sprang up locally among people that knew her and things, and rumors circulated, and eventually these things are spoken of today by many people as if they're true, and in fact they're not.
Well, it is indeed a case that just has, I think, perplexed so many people. Does law enforcement use it as a training course in any of its law enforcement schools and programs?
I don't think they wouldn't want. Let me give you an idea of how law enforcement currently looks at the Zodiac case, at least in San Francisco. They're outsourcing their evidence. They are so determined to not have any involvement whatsoever in this case that they're sending their Zodiac letters that they have had in custody for decades. They're sending them to the Vallejo Police Department, which is a small police department. You know, the San Francisco Police Department sending their Zodiac letters to the Vallejo Police Department so that the Vallejo Police Department can do something with them. And all the Vallejo Police Department is doing is sending them to the crime lab, the state crime lab. And I'm like, why can't San Francisco police do that? I mean, it's they're determined. And they even had a Lieutenant Hennessy in the San Francisco Examiner a few weeks ago was quoted as saying that he, quote, hates the Zodiac case, unquote. And, you know, they'll alternately claim while you're in between putting you on hold for hours at a time when you call about the Zodiac case with tips or something, on one hand, they'll tell you, well, we can't discuss it because it's an active investigation. And other times they'll tell you that it's inactive and nobody's working on it. So it just depends. I guess the story you get depends on who happens to answer the phone at that time and how long you're on hold.
Well, the Zodiac is a hot potato case, too, politically. So it's tossed back and forth. It's closed. It's reopened. It's, you know, deactivated. It's reopened.
Did people lose their jobs over this case?
Dave Toski, one of the police officers portrayed in the movie, a homicide inspector for the San Francisco Police Department, who was assigned to the Paul Stein murder in San Francisco, amidst rumors and speculation that he was responsible for a forged Zodiac letter in 1978, he was removed from the case, removed from homicide, and put on pawn shop detail. There's been a lot of careers that haven't benefited from the Zodiac, that's for sure.
You know, the only person that's going to benefit is, well, here's the problem. In San Francisco, I think that there are examples of the San Francisco Police Department actually mishandling crucial evidence. And I think they realize that they cannot successfully prosecute this case because all a defense attorney would have to do is say, isn't it true that the recovered portion of the cab driver's shirt was stored in an unlocked room that was used for extra furniture? You know, I mean, that just shows that even if they get a DNA match, I mean, you can get reasonable doubt that the evidence was handled properly. And once you show that, then you can't convict anybody. And I think they realize that the upper echelon people within SFPD don't want to waste time on a case, waste resources on a case that they cannot ever convict successfully. And so, but you have detectives within SFPD who actually really want to serve the victims. But, you know, the upper management always wins. And so they're outsourcing materials. There is somebody that's actively working this in Riverside. Detective Shumway does an excellent job on that cold case, Cherry Joe Bates. And the Napa County Sheriff's Department has consistently done a great job. You can actually call and get through. They won't put you on hold for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And lately, the Vallejo Police Department has at least been sending this material off to the state crime lab. You know, why San Francisco couldn't have done that, I don't know. Maybe they don't have the address. I don't know.
Well, Tom, you know, Hennessy's not going to take your phone calls now because he's captain now. He's not a lieutenant.
Oh, well, you know what? And I'm sorry for anybody that was murdered in San Francisco, longer than 6 months ago, because guess what? And forget about it ever. You know, any type of investigation in San Francisco apparently only works if the case is less than 6 months old.
Michael, you do have a book out called The Zodiac Death Machine. Can people still get it?
No, it's not out yet. It'll be out later this year.
All right.
I'm still working on it. Completing work on it, especially after some of the developments that took place recently with the movie and the card that the Chronicle found and those things. I'm trying to make sure those get in the book before it's finished.
Let's talk about those episodes, too, when we come right back. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And then the website again for our guests here, zodiackiller.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Michael has another website as well. That is linked up with his name on the coasttocoastam.com website at zodiackillerfacts.com. But there's a link there. We make it very easy for you to get there. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment to continue our discussion about the Zodiac Killer, but I do want to tell you about the After Dark newsletter. You get it every month, and for a limited time now, we're going to give you two old classic shows, interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin, when you call 1-888-727-5505 or go online, coasttocoastam.com. Who wants to address the movie here, this incredible $85 million movie based on the books by Robert Graysmith? Ed Neal, Michael Butterfield, you?
I think that's probably mostly Michael's department there.
Okay, Michael, go ahead.
Well, as you said, the movie is based on the book by Robert Graysmith, and the book is widely known as a rather fictionalized version of the Zodiac story. So naturally, when you have a film that's based on police files and a highly fictionalized book, you're going to get a movie that lies somewhere in between.
Well, that's true, too. Hollywood's going to play with it. When's it expected out?
It's actually already been out for 3 weeks.
Oh, it is? I haven't even seen it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you better go quick, because it's not making very much money at the box office.
You know what? Are they marketing it well?
Oh, yeah. It's just people aren't going to see it. It's been out since March 2nd, and it's only grossed not even $30 million yet. It's not doing well at the box. The budget was like $85 million, and it's it would have made its most probably opening weekend, and that was 3 weeks ago. So.
Well, you know what? It came out when 300 came out, I guess, right around that same time period.
It came out the weekend before that. I think one of the reasons that the movie may not be doing very well is, number one, I think that a lot of the information that is in the movie, as I said, does come from Graysmith's book, and the stuff about Robert Graysmith's books have been on the internet for quite some time, so a lot of people may already be aware of some of the problems with that book. But I think also, you know, it's a long movie by any standards, and in today's day and age, a lot of people determine whether they're going to see a movie based on that alone.
Now, what's this about? This a card or something that the Chronicle got? Some kind of correspondent in 1990. What was that? Was
well,
that a
Tom's
letter?
Your man there.
Okay, Tom. Was it a letter, a card? What did they get?
Well, first, can I tell you, I gave the I just want to say real quick, because I saw the movie, the David Fincher movie. I did give it an excellent review, and I just wanted to get that in there. But the other thing is, upon further review, you know, sneak a flask into the theater, and that might have had something to do with my feelings about the film.
Tom, you've made reference to drinking quite a bit lately. Do we have a problem here?
But as far as the Eureka card, good, because there are 36 people in the chat room right now, and they're screaming that we talk about the Eureka card. Essentially what happened was the San Francisco Chronicle wanted to have a story that they could publish about the Zodiac that would coincide with the film. And so they assigned a reporter named Daniel King to put together some materials, and he had written a Zodiac story a year ago. And so he was familiar with the case, and he had visited my website quite a few times, and he was familiar with the Zodiac's handwriting. And so he was in the San Francisco Chronicle library, and he was thumbing through their materials, I guess looking for potential artwork for the story. And he found this red envelope, and it wasn't a scan, it was an actual envelope, and it had handwriting that he recognized to be very similar to the Zodiac's. And so he opened the envelope. It had already been opened, like with a paper, with a letter opener or something, but he looked inside, and it was a greeting card, Happy Holidays greeting card, and inside the greeting card was a Xerox copy of a couple postal P.O. books, Keith.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at the postmark, and it had been postmarked in December of 1990 in Eureka, California. So he emailed me and said, "Have you ever heard about a possible Zodiac letter from 1990 in Eureka?" And I said, "No, I haven't. Please give me details." And so he sent me another email just detailing what kind of card it was, what the circumstances were. And I started to get really excited because it just sounded too legitimate and too subtle for a hoaxer. And I asked him to scan me the documents, and he was worried about handling them. And I said, just be careful and just proceed like it's an authentic communication. Don't be using it as a to set your beer on or something, and just be careful. But I mean, scanning it, you know, that's not going to, as far as I know, it's not going to harm the actual card. So he scanned the envelope, he scanned the card, front and back, and he scanned the Xerox. And when I'll never forget, you know, when I first opened that attachment in my email and I saw that handwriting, I knew, I think I probably yelled or something. I don't remember. It's all pretty blurry, but I
probably yelled Eureka.
Yeah, exactly. And that was, might have been the intent of the person who sent it. With that
it is very striking when you see the card. Even those of us who didn't want to believe that it was authentic are kind of forced to accept that it probably is, at least from what it looks like.
Yeah, the subtleties of writing are such that I don't think it's something that really hoaxed. In fact, at my message board at ZodiacKiller.com, I actually have a challenge for people. You know, there are a few people, a vast majority believe that it's probably authentic, but there are a few that are saying, oh, anybody could fake it. And so I set a challenge up for people to mail me their best forgery attempts. And I've received, you know, all the blowhards always disappear when you actually get in their face and challenge them. I've received four attempts, and it's pretty obvious that they were traced or something like that. So this is just, if either this is either an authentic Zodiac communication from Eureka, or it's a Picasso level piece of art that, you know, the guy.
George, I think it's important to remember too that one of the reasons it's so striking is because the Zodiac Halloween card from the original case back in the day was a secret PAL card. And the card that was sent in 1990 was also a card that said, from your secret pal, you're still wondering who I am, look inside, and when you open it up, it says, I'll keep you guessing.
Yeah.
Jeez. And these keys, these Xerox of these keys, which may be a clue or just a wild goose chase, were inside.
Still playing a game, isn't he?
If it was him, it's very, as we keep saying tonight, it's very much like the kinds of games that Dennis Rader was playing at the time that he got himself arrested and caught.
Why do we say him? Could it be a woman?
Oh, he was seen by so many people. He
okay.
He's spoken with one of the victims.
Was a guy.
And plus, the way he was described as dressing, women have a much better fashion sense than that. I mean, come on, dark blue trousers and a white and a brown jacket. I mean, come on.
Whoever said a serial killer knows how to dress, huh?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, he certainly, as you know, if you've seen any of the sketches or anything from the case, he definitely wore a very bizarre costume at Lake Berryessa that day. Tom pointed out one time, he's one of the few serial killers in history to have a costume.
Yeah, that's not usually something. Most of them don't play dress up like that and create like an executioner's costume and sew on it and do all these things. It was pretty.
Well, he had the crossed circle symbol on his chest the way, you know, a knight would or a superhero or something.
And I know Ed has seen some recreations. In fact, I think Ed tested a couple fake attempts on that costume that Zodiac wore at Lake Berryessa.
2002.
It's very difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In
meticulously
fact,
hand-stitched, white stitched cross circle on it, a hood that was squared at the top.
Obviously, he was very handy with needle and thread.
Ed Neal, if they arrested the Zodiac Killer and they gave you an opportunity to go in and talk with them, what are some of the first things you would ask?
Oh, wow.
That's pretty deep, George.
I know it. It's a deep show.
I think the first thing that I would ask him is, you know, there's what
now, this,
would
this
you
is
want
you, Michael,
to ask
right?
him and what would he answer? You know,
well, let's
I'd
say
ask
he
him,
answered,
how could you let this go on so long?
That's you, Michael, right? That's your voice. Okay, what about you, Ed? Ed's still thinking.
Well, I know. It's like, wow, what do I ask? There's actually a thread on the message board about that, and I haven't chimed in yet. So I'm thinking what I would ask, I mean, if he was arrested, say, based on the physical evidence, or if he had, you know, any of the weapons, Paul Stein shirt, wallet, car keys, and there was no doubt it was him, before we knew anything else about him, I think what I would ask is, who was the closest at getting it right about who you are, what makes you tick? That I would be really curious about.
I would probably ask him, why did he start and why did he stop?
And what did he get out of it? You know, was it worth it?
Yeah. It seems to me that, you know, if indeed the first murder that's attributed to him was his first murder ever, something must have happened to the guy, don't you think?
Well, you know, anybody who studied serial killers will tell you that their behavior manifests itself very early in life. And many of the serial killers that have been captured, we end up finding out that they were responsible for murders an age far younger than we had suspected, and had covered them up and resurfaced later in life. Even Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy were suspected of murders as teenagers. And I think it's possible that, you know, if the Zodiac was caught, you probably would find out that there's some incident in his life that may have driven him to kill, but it was probably before that. Because I may disagree with Ed and Tom on this, I don't know, but to me, the Zodiac murders as we know them in Northern California don't strike me as someone's first attempt at murder.
I agree with that.
A little George, too adept at what he was doing, even at Lake Herman Road.
Yeah, you may be right there.
He may have been messy. I mean, at Presidio Heights, he was seen by four witnesses, was nearly caught twice in 2 minutes. So he lucked out there. So he was sloppy when it came to certain things, but he certainly was, I won't say polished, not like Ted Bundy was when he first came on the scene, but he certainly didn't know what he was doing.
Well, and there's also that murder in Riverside, which was in 1966, 2 years before the first known Zodiac murders, that many people do believe was at least the Zodiac's first murder, or perhaps one of the earlier ones.
That was Sherry Jo Bates?
Yes. She was murdered at Riverside City, near Riverside City College in 1966. She had gone into a library, and when she came out, apparently her car had been disabled by this unknown individual, and somehow he was able to get her to an area near the library where he stabbed her to death. And
oh, my.
1 month later, there was three handwritten letters sent on notebook paper and written in pencil. One was sent to a local newspaper, one was sent to the police, and one was sent to her father. And they all said Bates had to die. There will be more. And there was a small symbol at the bottom that resembled a Z. Then there was the confession letter that came also, as we spoke of earlier. And handwriting experts have determined that those writings were done by the Zodiac. There are a few who disagree, but, you know, that's a sign that he may have been killing much earlier than people suspected.
What's so bizarre is, you know, here, like in Sherry Jo Bates's case, here's a woman who goes to the library. And, you know, she's thinking about her day's events, maybe her date over the weekend, comes out, and she gets killed. I mean,
and if it was the Zodiac or whoever it was, you know,
whoever it was.
The calculating nature to disable her car and lure, you know, she comes out, she finds her car doesn't work, so he probably comes up and pretends to be a helpful stranger and offers her a ride, which is what this letter, the confession letter, said. And as they were walking away, you know, he said, "I think it's about time." And she said, "What?" And he said, "It's about time for you to die."
Oh,
that's a very cold-blooded kind of person. It's very much like the cab driver killing, where the guy thought he was going to be paid for the fare and got a bullet instead.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really sad, really, about the Bates deal, too, is that before she left for the last, wrote a note for her father that just said, "Dad went to," I think it said, "went to RCC library," and she signed. And, you know, when you, now that you know what happened to her, when you see an image of that note, it's really heart-wrenching. And she was, her brother Michael was a big source of information for me. He was so generous, and he sent me just like a huge box full of her materials and yearbooks and all, and newspaper articles and glossy photos. And you know, I really just appreciate what he did, because, and also the Riverside Police Department. You know, I rant a little bit about the San Francisco Police Department, which actually they have some great people working for them. It's just I don't agree with their policy about the Zodiac case, but the Riverside Police and Steve Shumway especially are just, you know, they're doing everything you'd hope they would do for her. And that includes, in day and age when a lot of law enforcement agencies don't want to share with websites, the Riverside Police Department have the exact opposite attitude. And for the 40th anniversary of Sherry's murder just a few months ago, they provided me with incredible high-resolution, glossy images of the library inside and out, where she was last seen, her Volkswagen, just an unbelievable series of photos that our police, that no one had ever seen outside of the police department.
And what's more amazing about that, Tom, is the fact that, you know, they don't even really believe the Zodiac was involved.
No, they just want to find out.
And still being cooperative.
Yeah, exactly. That's just that's the way to do it, in my opinion. And the hoarding information, keeping it secret, and keeping everybody at arm's length. These cold cases get solved by the public. They get solved by forensic scientists. They don't get solved by detectives re-interviewing people. You know, they get solved by somebody sending a tip in to a website or by a match that's made by a computer in a DNA database bank. And so to ignore that, that's a simple fact as far as I'm concerned. And to ignore it is just irresponsible. I think it's, once a case is a few years old, you know, 10 years old, 20 years old, release the information, release the photos. If there's a website, cooperate with it. And you owe it at least that much to the victims, I would think.
Most family members don't even suspect their brother or sister or son or daughter that they might be doing this, do they?
No, apparently.
No. And their wives.
And wives, like you know, the BK killer.
BK, yeah, Dennis Reed's wife
killer.
Had absolutely no idea.
Yeah, there's a...
Gary Ridgway, same thing. John Wayne Gacy, his wife didn't suspect.
Herb Baumeister, who was, you know, bringing home the bones of his victims and discarding them on his property, and even his wife and children found one of them at one time, and he was still managed to deceive them. It's, you know, you have to be a very cold, calculating kind of person to be able to hide that second secret life.
Well, George, you know, Ted Bundy worked with Ann Rule, and she didn't suspect a thing, and that's Ann Rule. You know, they worked together.
Well, that's true.
Well, he used to, you know, tell Ann Rule to be careful, watch out for that killer when it was him.
Yeah.
Why does a killer, a serial killer, you know, sometimes kill at random, and yet they could be friends with someone, pals with someone, and nothing would ever happen to that individual?
Because they've become human beings instead of objects.
Yes,
as soon as someone becomes personalized to you,
they won't do it, will they?
Yeah, that's why they always tell, you know, when someone's been kidnapped and they have the parents on television, they always ask that they repeat the child's name over and over and over again, because the more you begin to identify with a person as a human being, the less likely you are to be able to turn off that moral part of you that can kill just an object.
Yeah, Ted Bundy had once observed, I think, to, what was his name, Keppel? Ted Keppel, something like that.
Ted, yeah.
He once observed that, you know, while he was in jail and everything, he said that he had, once he had chosen a victim, he had to kill her within 20 minutes, otherwise he'd start seeing her as a human being.
I think it was it Robert Keppel?
Robert Keppel.
Yeah, Bob Keppel.
Yeah.
That's why it's so important that, you know, usually a killer will make some effort to disable the person immediately so that they can't speak or interact with them.
Yeah, there was actually one incident with Ted Bundy where there was a woman who had related that what happened. Her car had been disabled when she came out of a bar. She ended up getting a ride home, but like 4 in the morning, she was concerned about it being stolen or something. She got a taxi back, and who should show up but Ted Bundy? And he offered to help her, and it's dead. It's like, well, let's go buy some jumper cables. And as it turned out, that's not exactly what he had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think he was holding a knife to her throat and driving, made her undress, and she's trying to think of anything she could say. And finally she said, you know, it's like my daughter's at home all alone, and she's going to be really worried, you know, when I don't come home. And at that point, he pulled over and told her to get out. So at that point, she became human to him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And off he went.
He took off, and she survived, fortunately. So.
The serial killers seem to have like a 20-minute delay, like radios, you know, radio programs like those have a 10-second delay or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The serial killers have like a 20-minute delay where if you last the 20 minutes, then you're safe and they see you as a real person. But if you don't last the 20 minutes, then you're just something.
They'll get you fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're gonna take phone calls when we come back, and I'm gonna open up a special topic line, the Zodiac Killer line, and let's just keep that open just in case. Long shot. But please don't call it unless you have to. That's 818-817-0021.